Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. In this episode, we'll be talking to Glacier Farm Media Machinery Editor Scott Garvey about the big debate over right to repair. We'll also talk to Farmtario Editor John Gregg about a surprising report on farm-level food waste. Phil Franz-Workington of Markets Farm will fill us in on the action in the commodity markets. But up first is the Manitoba Cooperator's Lorraine Stevenson, who will tell us all about the birds and the beef. Lorraine, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gord.
So, you were recently at a conference that explored beef production and its impact on conservation. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this event is now in its 12th year, and it attracts from all over the country research scientists, conservation organizations, agricultural industry, community leaders. It's called the Prairie Conservation Endangered Species Conference. I understand about 300 people were there this year. The session I was sitting in asked for a show of hands, and the room was split about 50-50 as to those who said they were wearing ag and or conservation hats. Packed agenda, nearly 100 different presentations on public engagement to policy and land management, all, of course, working towards this common objective of a working agricultural landscape that meets conservation objectives. It was sponsored by the Canadian Agricultural Partnership, Province of Manitoba, Canadian Beef, large numbers of conservation groups like Ducks Unlimited, and co-chaired by Manitoba Beef Producers. So all the key players in the room with respect to raising beef and conservation work at the table.
So that doesn't happen very often, and you noted in your story that conservationists need to become better beef advocates for their own good. And why is that?
Well, the session I was sitting in on was one devoted to the SARPAL approach. SARPAL stands for Species at Risk Partnerships on Agricultural Lands. It's an Environment and Climate Change Canada initiative, and it's focused on working with farmers to support the recovery of species at risk on ag land. Here in Manitoba, a very large initiative is underway in a partnership with Manitoba beef producers to support landowners whose grazing practices are protecting some of the last remaining tracts of habitat for threatened grassland bird species. What was emphasized in the session I wrote about is that virtually all the land that's still home to these species is private land. That's private landowners are who conservation is dealing with, and that those farmers can only have viable farms so long as there's strong demand pull for beef. Sales of beef is essentially what keeps the grasslands, plain and simple, because it's what keeps livestock producers in business. And it's a reasonable question to ask, what are the prospects of consumers eating less meat in future? What does that mean for the beef industry's long-term prospects? Farmers cannot protect species at risk on land they convert to cropland to keep the farm viable. And really, there's only so much the beef sector can do insofar as talking about the environmental benefits of eating beef. It needs partners to get that message across. So that's where the discussion was going. It was about how the conservation movement, if it really and truly wants the cattle industry as its partner, it needs to start talking about that.
And I think that that message of partnership is a powerful one, but I'm not sure that that's always been the case. How are cattle producers currently viewing conservationists and vice versa?
Well, that was a pretty compelling conversation in this session, and some very thoughtful and very candid perspectives shared from both sides. Lots of frank talk about the distrust that's long existed between them, from the beef producer's perspective, saying, you know, the farmer that was speaking said they've personally only had good experiences working with conservation programs themselves, but that generally there's been a long and it's still a deep well of mistrust between the industry and conservation overall. The way that producer summed it up, he said, you know, I've looked at you and said, I think you're trying to steal my land. And you've looked at me and said, I think you're trying to ruin the land. And so thoughts from the conservation side on that was that, yes, it truly has been antagonistic. And what it's really boiled down to is an asymmetrical relationship. Conservation is asking something from the beef sector, but not really giving back to it, or it's a question as to what it's giving back to it, other than possibly couched expressions of support and incentive programs whose benefits accrue to individual producers. That comment made there was that what the industry has been hearing is that, well, conservation would be 100% behind you if you would only just graze a little better or differently, or let us tell you how to graze a little better. So conservation groups are saying, you know, they hope they're getting past that perhaps, but there's still more to be done to right that relationship.
And a relationship's always built on shared interests. So where is the common ground here?
Well, simply the common ground is that both sides are squared with a society that has little or no understanding whatsoever of the implications of their diet on the environment. Specifically what beef in or not in that diet, beef on or not the dinner plate, what that ultimately means for the conservation of rangeland and the grass where these threatened birds and other animals remain. There's just, as they both say, there's a huge need to start talking about that.
So, and then once that conversation has been had, how can conservation groups better advocate for beef? What should they be doing?
Well, that's what the speakers on conservation were saying at this session. Simply, they need to become more vocal defenders and advocates for the cattle industry and for eating beef. It was said that it's time to stop making couch statements in support of the beef industry and really get beyond their own circles to say that the beef industry is a conservation group in and of itself. And it is conservation's most fundamental partner. And to just start to get the message across to those who think beef is bad for the environment, that the exact opposite is true. In short, the conservation community needs to step up and start talking about the conservation side of the beef story.
Well, that's really interesting. It's a completely new way, for me at least, of looking at this whole question. Thanks so much, Lorraine.
You're very welcome.
That was the Manitoba Cooperators' Lorraine Stevenson telling us about how conservationists can and should step up and lend their voice to the beef sector. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Later in the show, we'll be speaking to FarmTerio editor John Gregg about just where food waste happens in Canada, and Phil Franz Workington of Markets Farm will bring us up to date on the commodity markets. But first, we're joined by Glacier Farm Media machinery editor Scott Garvey to fill us in on the right to repair debate. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
So in simple terms, Scott, can you tell us what is the right to repair and how it's become an issue?
The whole issue kind of started with in the consumer electronics sector, and kind of farm machinery kind of got drawn into it with the addition of high digital component in machines. And John Deere kind of became the poster child for drawing the ire of a lot of the people who were really pushing this issue because it restricted access to the engine control modules, or essentially the brain of the tractor, and coming out publicly and saying that, or essentially they equated it to a book. They said, if you buy a book at a store, you can wrinkle the pages, you can write in the margins or do whatever you like, but you have no right to change what the author wrote. And they said, our software code essentially comes under that provisions. It's proprietary. You're not allowed to go in there. If you buy the tractor, you must accept that you cannot get into its brain and change any of its thinking. That didn't go down well with a lot of people, especially those consumer advocates who saw an analogy between farm equipment in that respect and the issues they were having with their Apple phone that they couldn't get into. And so the ag sector kind of got drawn into that consumer dispute, I guess you would call it.
So if I'm interpreting what you're saying properly, then the machinery manufacturers, they're justifying these limitations based on essentially copyright?
That's the foundation for it. But unlike the consumer electronics sector, where it's a matter of can I buy a cheap overseas battery to put in my iPhone, or do I have to go back to Apple and get a branded one? So with farm machinery, the issue is a little different. The engine control module, or the ECM, it's really a bit of a misnomer. It controls all sorts of functions of a machine, and that includes some of the safety aspects of the machine. So the argument made by the major brands is, as we go down this route toward autonomy, these computers are regulating a vast number of the machine functions. So if we allow anyone to go in and start modifying code, the ramifications, the unintended consequences of that could affect some overall drivability characteristics of the machine, and they could affect safety. So they're saying, we don't want to get sued because a tractor ran over somebody when it should have been not in gear or something like that, and that could happen if inexperienced or unqualified people get into the ECM and start making changes without really fully understanding the consequences.
But does that, I mean, I guess I see what they're saying, but, you know, I mean, people have been modifying equipment off-label for years, you know, cars and hot rods and whatnot. This doesn't seem to be that much different. Does it raise the question, though, of who actually owns the equipment?
Well, that's what the debate has been. It's like, we paid the money, we want to do whatever we want to do with it. And that's why John Deere came out with the book analogy that, well, yes, you buy the book, but you don't own the content. That didn't necessarily go over all that well with a lot of the advocates. They're saying, no, it doesn't carry over. But there is copyright law in the U.S., and there's some agreements, reciprocal agreements with Canada that suggest it does, but there's also some exemptions to that rule. As I understand, I'm not a copyright lawyer, but there are some exceptions that allow an owner of, say, a cell phone to copy out the software code so they could have it secure in a second location, that if something happened, they could reformat the phone back to its original condition. So Deere doesn't like to allow that either, or all the major brands. Essentially, they've all taken the same position. Really, Deere's just seems to be the public focus of it because they've been sort of at the forefront of this. And they're saying, yeah, but that still is getting you into the machine. It's still allowing you to mess with it. We don't want you to mess with it.
So you've talked a little bit about how the people who kind of pay attention to these issues, the advocates and so on, have reacted to these sort of issues. What about sort of the more standard rank and file farmer, farm groups, that sort of thing? Are they beginning to sort of sit up and pay attention?
Well, again, this comes as an issue more prevalent in the United States than here in Canada. And actually, one of the farm groups from California was the one who had a very strong position on this, and their efforts actually resulted in the announcement last year by the Manufacturers Association, the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, which represent John Deere and all the major brands, and got them to come forward and say, all right, by the year 2021, we're going to make all of these tools, manuals, and diagnostic equipment available to end users. So you can repair the tractor. You can go into the ECM and repair. But they put a caveat on that and said, while we're going to allow you to repair, we're not going to allow you to change or rewrite code. So some of the California group was happy with that, the farmers group. But again, a lot of advocacy groups are not. They still see that as an infringement on their right to do what they choose with the machine. So really it has been producer organizations that have sort of forced the manufacturer's hand on this.
And now I think that I read recently some legislators are starting to address this in law. What can you tell us about that? Have you heard anything about
that? There's been, I think it's the last total was 18 U.S. states that have legislation pending or on the books in the state legislatures. Some of them, Nebraska's in particular, is specific to ag equipment. Some of the others are general consumer product legislation. The major brands have been objecting to all of them and are still continuing to do that. They see their recent sort of compromise with allowing this these tools to be made available as a solution that meets the needs of any legitimate producer who owns one of these machines and therefore is making legislation unnecessary. Of course, litigation, the U.S. is kind of a well ahead of us in terms of the amount of litigation that happens, and so it's not really surprising that all that litigation is happening down there. I haven't heard of any litigation in Canada anywhere along those lines. We're kind of just watching what happens down there.
Well, that's great. Thanks a lot for filling us in, Scott.
My pleasure.
That was Glacier Farm Media Machinery Editor Scott Garvey on the controversial world of right-to-repair farm equipment. This is Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. A bit later, we'll speak with Market Farm's Phil Franz Workington about what's happening in the markets. But first, here's John Gregg, editor of Farmtario, to tell us about food waste in Canada. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gord.
So we've heard a lot about consumer food waste, but not as much about food waste at the production level. What did this study say that you were looking at?
Well, the study that came out recently said that about 24% of the food produced that doesn't end up eaten by consumers is lost at the farm level. That compares to about 34% at the processing level, and then the rest at food service, restaurants, distribution, or in people's homes. The study is called the Avoidable Crisis of Food Waste Study. It was conducted by the Second Harvest Food Rescue Organization, and it was completed by the Value Chain Management International Company. And it's really the first study that looks at the actual weight of food, and because they had some actual industry data, a lot of the other food waste studies have more estimated food waste based on production levels. So this having the actual food weight should help for benchmarking across the sector and with other countries and other areas.
Now, they make a distinction in this study between food waste and food loss, especially relating at the farm level. Why is that?
Well, I think their point is that, you know, there's some food that's not harvested and some that's lost in storage, there's some that's lost to weather, but it isn't already at the edible form that the food is, say at food service or in people's homes, when it's wasted. So they came up with a different lexicon, which I think makes sense, that if it doesn't get to processing or doesn't get to distribution, I guess I'd say, because they referred to loss in the processing and at the farm and production level, if it doesn't, it's more lost if it doesn't get to a distribution point where it's at the point where it can be consumable.
So how much variation is there among commodities when it comes to food loss at the production level?
So there's some very interesting data in this study on differences between sectors and when it comes to food loss. So the challenge is, how do you compare the food loss in different sectors? So for example, the fruit and vegetable sector has a significant waste, and they're able to more easily manage that just basically due to the data that's available. So if you think that there were 3 million tons lost for dairy, 1.28 million tons for meat and poultry, and then that compares to almost 22 million tons in field crops and almost 8 million tons for fruit and vegetables. So it's very hard to know what apples to oranges you can compare in that, just because of nutrient density. And you have to keep in mind the total tonnage produced by those different sectors. So if you think of the total tonnage produced by the whole grains and oilseed sector, it would be massive compared to the tonnage produced by the meat sector. So how do those numbers compare? But still, they're interesting. It's interesting to show that there's more significant loss volume in the crop side than there is in the livestock side. Although you need to keep in mind that interpretation, they're still working on interpretation and some new, and they're hoping to do more research on that as they go forward.
So why is measuring food loss at the production level challenging? It sounds like it is.
If you think of what it takes to bring in a crop or raise animals, there's so many uncontrollable factors, and farmers know about those all too well. Weather, for example. So where do you draw a line that says, well, that's just weather loss, nobody could manage that, or quality loss because of weather? How do you factor that in? Or, for example, contracting losses, and that's one of the big issues in fruit and vegetable farming, because a lot of it is contracted, and if you produce more than your contract, or what you're producing doesn't meet the very precise specifications of the contract, then often that food just rots in the field. So how do you, or overproduction? Say you have a really, really good year, yet you have a higher percentage of loss because of the weather. So how do you quantify those and define those? That's a challenge. And what it comes down to is Martin Gooch, who's the head of Value Chains Management International, told me that he thinks that 24% figure is fairly conservative, that there's probably only about 6% of that farm production loss that can actually be reduced because of just the bigger factors that are uncontrollable at the farm level.
So that does, however, raise the obvious question. What should or could be done at the production and farm level to limit food loss?
So whenever a farmer produces something that's not saleable, that's a financial loss because they've paid for the inputs and the labor to produce it. And if you get to the end point of at some point that it's not saleable or there's a loss, it's a financial loss. So there is a financial imperative for farmers to be more efficient, although they've been working on that for hundreds of years now. So, however, there's also the fact that Martin Gooch said that there's a responsibility in the rest of the value chain to do better coordination. The food sector is a pull-through sector, and often when it goes through a door between different areas, there's not a lot of communication back. And he says as the distribution and food service and restaurant and retail sides get more and more pressure on food waste, that he expects and hopes there will be some more options created so that, say, a contract is filled and a farmer still has another 20% production, that there will be mechanisms whereby that food can be used and go into a stream that eventually gets to people somehow. So, but that's still going to take a fair bit of, motivation and investment somewhere along the food chain before it gets back to the farmer level.
Well, that's very interesting. Thanks a lot for that report, John.
Thanks, Gord. Take care.
That was Farmtario editor John Gregg telling us about food waste on the farm. This is Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. And last, but certainly not least, we're joined by Phil Franz Workington of Markets Farm to fill us in on what's been going on in the markets. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Gord.
Oh, you're very welcome. So, the bearish technical charts. We saw canola drop to contract lows yesterday and down again today being the 26th of February. How low can it go?
How low can it go is a good question. Yeah, the March contract, which is the nearby, it's broke below kind of four. Longer term, going back to 2016, 475 to 480. That's kind of been support on the weekly charts for going on 3 years now. The March contract is at 466 as we're talking right now. More attention's on May, really, but it's at 473. So that's breaking below some major kind of long-term support levels. I was talking to a trader just earlier today, and he said, you know, I don't want to say it, but 450 is a possibility. And that's solely from a chart standpoint. The fundamentals aren't that great either to warrant. There's always room for a kind of a bounce. People take profits and it goes up, but there's large supplies of canola out there that will, keep things under pressure, even if it does try to bounce. And at the same time, the U.S. soybean situation, they got big supplies, and South America's harvesting a crop. So there's more signals pointing lower than up right now, and how low it goes remains to be seen, because as soon as I say it's going to keep going lower, that's when it bounces. But
well, we'll hope that that's the case this time.
Exactly.
Speaking of trade, though, you talk about China and the U.S. and their trade talks is what everybody's talking about. There's the soybean situation. How many U.S. soybeans can China buy? We've seen optimistic headlines. What's your take on it?
Yeah, that's the optimistic headlines are the thing. I think it was just over the weekend that was said China's going to buy 10 million more tons of U.S. soybeans. So soybeans, you know, had an immediate reaction to that higher, but soybeans are, it's all been talk and tweets and kind of optimistic rally cries, but there's no real meat behind that yet. So beans are down today. Soy oil is down. They're kind of U.S. traders are at the point where we've heard all of the optimism when something real going to happen. So if that does happen, sure, there could be a move higher. But at the same time, there's questions how many beans China could actually buy, and even if they do buy a lot, what price? They're going to want to pay up, especially with South America. Their harvest is underway right now, and they're will be undercutting whatever the U.S. price has as well. So that's another sort of bearish anchor on things.
And let's talk a little bit about South America. It's a little hard to believe looking out at the frozen landscape and bouncing over the rutted ice on the way in this morning, but they are harvesting soybeans down there. Brazil, I heard. What's that looking like so far?
Yeah, the Brazil, they just, their group out of there just had a report out. I think it was about half of the soybean harvest is already done, and that's running well ahead of normal when it would normally be only a quarter done. So the harvest is running ahead of normal. So that's kind of a negative factor on prices. But they did have kind of hot, dry growing conditions, which is, probably related to why the harvest is so far ahead. So yields are down a bit, so it's kind of, might cancel out. But overall, even if yields are down a bit in Brazil, it's still pretty large, millions upon millions of tons of soybeans that will need to go somewhere on the world market.
So, and as they're thinking harvest, we are, believe it or not, starting to think about spring seeding just around the corner. I think you noted in some of your notes for the conversation we're having. What are you watching in terms of weather and so on as the spring does approach?
The winter feels like it's going on forever this year, but the Weather Network had their spring forecast out, and they're predicting that, it's the middle of March. That's what we have to wait for, and then there's a switch is going to flip, according to them, and it'll go from winter to spring, and, which will be welcomed in some cases, but on the other hand, that kind of quick turnaround also means that snow will be melting at a quick pace, and that raises the risk of flooding, especially when there's a fair bit of snow in many areas. Here in Winnipeg, there are already worries about a spring flood along the Red River, and there's similar situations in other river valleys across the prairies.
And then just to wrap up, Phil, what's going on with the U.S. Wheat futures? We've seen some excitement this week, I understand.
Yeah, they are excitement being, they've seen some big moves like day to day up or down. Today is a bit more of a, today being Tuesday, spring wheat at least is sort of stabilizing, but the winter wheats have all been moving lower, hitting some of their lowest levels in the past year, really. And that's mainly due to kind of the U.S. keeps having trouble on the export front, with Russia in particular keeps exporting wheat despite tightening supplies there. And the European wheat is at some of its lowest price levels, and so cheaper wheat from France and other countries, Romania, is moving into export positions that the U.S. might typically be able to sell into. So that's kind of keeping the wheat market under pressure. But yeah, I guess the one silver lining on that, as far as Canadian perspective goes, is that spring wheat has not had the same kind of bearish, you know, it's still bearish, but not as bearish, if you'd put it that way. It hasn't gone down as much, so that could be a little supportive for, you know, the spring wheat that Canada is growing for the most part.
Well, that's great. Thanks for that, Phil.
You're welcome.
That was Markets Farms' Phil Franz-Workington making sense of the markets for us. That's another edition of Between the Rows from Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore, saying so long, and we hope you'll join us next time.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to etr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.